Hello and welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. I'm your host, Montse Alvarado.
I also know the importance of gender-affirming medical care for transgender people.
Puberty-suppressing hormones and surgeries for minors with gender dysphoria. Top U.S. health officials support it, but these controversial treatments are coming under greater scrutiny.
Many, many countries are looking at it and saying, look, there are a lot of very negative long-term effects from puberty blockers.
As England bans puberty blockers, education on transgenderism is called into question in the U.K.
We should be careful about teaching contested concepts to young and impressionable children.
And we look at the medical, ethical, and societal implications of transgender healthcare.
Not only deny reality, but insist that others have to adopt your beliefs.
Understanding of transgender theory is by no means settled.
LGBTQ plus people, children particularly, must be recognised and included in the same way as heterosexual relationship education.
I also do not want to see young children at primary school to be taught about changing gender.
A debate in the United Kingdom on teaching controversial LGBTQ plus sex education as well as gender transition in schools. The debate in the UK comes after England's National Health Service, or NHS, sparked global reaction for removing puberty-suppressing hormones, or PSH, as a treatment for children with gender dysphoria. That new policy went into effect on April 1st. The NHS made the decision after commissioning a review of several studies. In a statement, they announced, "We have concluded that there is not enough evidence to support the safety or clinical effectiveness of PSH, that's puberty-suppressing hormones, to make the treatment routinely available at this time. PSH, or puberty blockers, will only be available for research and in some private clinics in the UK. The NHS says treatment will focus on psychosocial and psychological support with hormones and surgery available to people 18 years or older. While the move to ban puberty blockers in England was blasted by LGBTQ plus groups, it did find some support from Parliament and the UK's Health Minister. The United Kingdom is not the only European country to change course on how they treat gender incongruence. Norway's Healthcare Investigation Board ruled in 2023 a lack of medical evidence supporting puberty blockers or reassignment surgery and issued guidelines to restrict those methods to research settings only. Sweden, the first country to introduce legal gender reassignment in the 70s, changed course in 2022 when Swedish health officials issued guidelines limiting puberty blockers, hormones, and mastectomies for minors. Along similar lines, Finland urges psychotherapy instead of puberty blockers, with surgery not offered to those under 18. France calls for the utmost reserve on hormone treatments for minors, and now lawmakers are calling for a ban on gender transition for minors. The American College of Pediatricians says puberty blockers may cause harmful side effects to young children, including brittle bones and mental illness. Infertility is also a possible side effect, even if the hormone treatments are cut short. But the American Medical Association supports puberty blockers, saying it lowers rates of depression and suicidal ideation. The Biden administration has taken a strong stance in support of gender transition, even for minors.
Gender-affirming care is both medically necessary and actually life-saving, especially for transgender youth.
Dr. Levine, the Assistant Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, advocates for so-called gender-affirming care, particularly for youth. A physician and former professor of pediatrics and psychiatry at Penn State College of Medicine, Dr. Levine is the first openly transgender person, a man presenting as a woman, to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. The Department of Justice under President Biden has filed multiple statements of interest and amicus briefs supporting litigation against state laws that would ban gender transition hormones or surgery for youth that struggle with their gender identity. Less than half of U.S. states have passed laws or policies to restrict, ban, or criminalize puberty blockers and or gender transition surgeries for minors, according to KFF, a nonprofit that studies health policy. Some of these states are facing legal challenges to those laws, including Florida and Idaho. Tennessee and Kentucky laws have been challenged by parents of children who wanted the procedures and have been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. More states are looking to pass bans, including Kansas and South Carolina. And Connecticut is looking to enshrine gender-affirming care in the state constitution. As states debate laws on hormone blockers, a new report claims that one of the strongest advocates for gender transition medicine, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, or WPATH, which is globally recognized as being at the forefront of the novel field of gender medicine, was widely aware of horrific and potentially fatal side effects of these treatments, but supported them anyway. The report published by the group Environmental Progress details leaked internal files from WPATH that describe sterilization, loss of sexual function, liver tumors, and even death as side effects from gender treatments. The report goes on to claim that WPATH members take part in medical abuse and violate ethical standards in medicine by admitting that both children and their parents truly don't understand the lifelong consequences of this controversial intervention and calls for a federal investigation into these practices. Dr. Joseph Meany, the president of the National Catholic Bioethics Center, joins us now to talk about the ethical concerns involved in these procedures and policies. Welcome to the show, Dr. Meany. These leaked files in the report issued by the Center for Environmental Progress indicates that doctors are violating medical standards of ethics. If this is true, what are the consequences, and can this be buried so that they can continue to do what they've been doing, imposing these treatments on children?
So one of the things that's very important about the development of bioethics is that informed consent, realizing what is going to be proposed to a person and then making an informed choice, is really the minimum standard. And any time that experimental procedures or procedures that have known bad side effects are done on people that do not consent, that is a grave, grave ethical violation and really should be illegal.
And it's because they haven't fully explained the impact of these procedures. What does informed consent actually involve?
So informed consent means that the person is capable of understanding, and then they're provided with all the reasonable information they need to make a good ethical choice, a good medical choice for themselves.
So one of the pieces of this that is really shocking, it's that they removed the ability for these children to have these treatments, but in England, they will only prescribe puberty blockers to minors in a research setting. Is this ethical treatment of children, or are they running experiments on human beings, basically?
Correct. If it's research, it's human experimentation. And then the real question is, you know, is it ethical to do this in the first place? I mean, is there a real reason to do it? And then second of all, are there the risks proportional to the benefits? And I think many, many countries are looking at it and saying, look, there are a lot of very negative long-term effects from puberty blockers. And what are the good effects? It's very hard to see.
What could be the good effects? I mean, you see the range of consequences from sterilization to depression, suicidal thoughts, all kinds of consequences from taking these treatments and surgeries to change one's physical appearance. What are the positives there?
I think the other side would be saying that the positive is that you would be preventing some of the negative influence of gender dysphoria. But again, from a Catholic anthropological and ethical perspective, one has to be accepting of one's sex. If one is in denial of that, then one is basically going against nature, against creation, and really mistreating oneself, even possibly mutilating oneself.
Right. Well, the governing body of health in England and several countries in Europe are now saying that hormone blockers and similar treatments are really not backed by scientific evidence. Will others follow? Will this set a precedent that others will pick up?
I think, you know, if people are truly trying to do what is best scientifically, they will take notice and say, look, there's very little evidence that this has any positive effects, and there is evidence that there are negative effects. So just from a purely medical perspective, I think many people will be turning away from this. I think Europe, in a certain sense, started first, and they're stopping first. And I think other countries will follow, just seeing, you know, the evidence as what it is.
How much harm is enough? You have a lot of young people who are detransitioning online. They're looking for law firms and filing cases to get damages from the doctors who did not tell them the real severe consequences of these actions. Is that going to have an impact?
I think so. I mean, one of the most important factors here is that young children who have gender confusion generally overcome that confusion once puberty arrives. So if they're taking puberty blockers, it sort of traps them in that sort of gender dysphoria mindset that they're in. And so actually doing nothing has the most beneficial effects. And just letting a little bit of time go by can help people with their gender dysphoria. And so why not try that?
Yeah, and I know that the National Catholic Bioethics Center and other medical organizations have been involved in several cases before all kinds of courts, not just the Supreme Court. One case was just denied at the end of March. It deals with gender incongruence and the new policies and procedures that promote it. Will the changes in Europe reach the United States fast enough to affect these cases at the Supreme Court?
I doubt it, because right now there's kind of an entrenched policy, particularly in the current administration, to support anything that is pro-transgender, gender-affirming treatments and all that. So I think there's going to be probably a need for some time to go by and some more evidence to come out and possibly, you know, different political leaders as well to take a look at this issue.
Well, certainly an issue for people to consider as the elections come up. Thank you so much, Dr. Meany.
Thank you.
Coming up, church teaching on gender and pastoral care, approach for those diagnosed with gender dysphoria. An expert weighs in. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Every person, regardless of expressed identity, is a beloved child of God.
Caring for those who suffer from gender dysphoria. The call to Catholics to love our brothers and sisters while upholding the truthful teachings of the Church. Mary Hassan, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, joins the program to give us more context on medical treatments and gender dysphoria. Mary, it's so great to have you here. You were part of a multi-episode series here on EWTN that unraveled all of the angles of this growing crisis. How do you even begin to tackle this subject?
I think it's important for Catholics to realize there is a truth about the human person, and we need to have confidence about that. Because when we're confident in the truth, then we can speak with love to someone who is suffering from confusion or distress over their body. And then I think the other important thing is to really be aware of the facts on the ground. So we've seen some tremendous changes in the medical field with a greater recognition of the harm that comes from using medical and surgical interventions to try to change the body, which you can't change a person's sex. But those things are helpful when we can marshal some of that evidence to really make the point that we know is true, that we're created out of love by God, male or female, and you can't change sex. We should embrace that.
That's a beautiful framework. You also run the Person and Identity Project at EPPC. Where is this push for transgender policies or ideological colonization, as Pope Francis would put it? Where is that push coming from?
Yeah, so it's really a confluence of interests. We see the ideologues, the activists, the people who really do believe that there is no truth, there is no human nature, that human beings should be able to reinvent themselves using technology with no boundaries, no even recognition of the boundary of reality, that you can't change sex. So that's one measure. But, you know, we wouldn't see what we're seeing through the culture if it were just the ideologues. The problem is there are some very wealthy philanthropists and foundations that have bought into the ideology, perhaps for their own reasons. We've seen corporations jump on board. The medical profession, unfortunately, really has a stake in this because they are making money off of vulnerable people who become confused and embark on this really endless road to try to achieve something that's impossible, to remake their bodies. So there's a lot of players here, governments as well, both on the international level as well as here in the U.S. The UN, unfortunately, really promotes this ideology. So Pope Francis's point that this is ideological colonization is it's a really sound point. It begins with ideology, but then it's pushed onto unwilling populations just by the power of money and influence and people with an agenda.
So then what is the end game, aside from the financial means there, the great promise of lots of money, either for doctors or for businesses? Is this separation of the human person from their body, is there an end there, an end goal, whether it's for the government or a societal end goal, to separate people from that?
Yeah, so the end goal is really the destruction of the family, destruction of religion, destruction of all of those moral norms and boundaries that have really been necessary for society and human flourishing. But those who are pushing this really truly believe that those are oppressive, and so they're working to dismantle that. So dismantle the idea of families, to say it's bigoted to expect that a person's inner feelings should match the reality of their body, or that it's bigoted to expect that males and females, or to acknowledge the truth that males and females are made one for another, and that's the foundation of the family. So unfortunately, it really is a big agenda. And that's not to say that the average person who becomes confused, or the adolescent who's distressed by their developing body and has come to believe they have, quote, a transgender identity. It's not to say that they're supporting or backing this kind of a larger goal. But the larger goal is what's driving this. That, and then obviously the opportunity to monetize this, which is a huge incentive.
Which is why it's so important to talk about it. Well, last year, Bill Maher joked on his HBO show that if trends continue as they are, all Americans will identify as gay in 2060. It was funny, but in all seriousness, is gender transition a social fad or a social contagion? And is that something that we can measure?
Yeah, so it is, at least within certain generations. We do have evidence that when you see a cluster effect, so for example, if in a friend group, one person is really struggling with identity and comes out as trans, more than likely within that friend group, you're going to have other young people who embark down that path. So that's one thing. I think the bigger problem is that as a society, we've accepted some of these premises that there is no truth to the body, that our body doesn't tell us anything about who we are, there is no human nature, there are no moral norms. And so we've seen in a number of surveys now that the number of young people, Generation Z, who identify as LGBTQ plus whatever it might be, you know, is close to 30%. It's 28% in one poll, about 26% in another, with projections that in the next 10 years, we're going to see about a third of that generation identifying as part of this rainbow community. And the significant thing there is that has huge implications, because they're voters and they're going to be choosing representatives who are going to represent those interests. And so it bodes ill for religious liberty, for parental rights, for free speech, all of those other issues that come into play here when you start to deny, not only deny reality, but insist that others have to adopt your beliefs and have to function within the framework that you're setting up.
Part of that insistence is language. Gender language is now being incorporated into laws around the world. In Scotland, on April 1st, legislation went into effect criminalizing hate speech for up to 7 years in prison. That legislation is broadly written to cover transgender identity. The author of Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling, has stood her ground on what gender is. On Twitter, she wrote, "If you genuinely imagine I delete posts calling a man so as not to be prosecuted under this ludicrous law, stand by for the mother of all April Fool's jokes." She's obviously very funny, but what are your thoughts on the political climate and speech regulations and restrictions around gender transition?
So I think this is an important thing to realize, that there are a lot of people who may not accept Catholic teaching, for example, about the truth of the human person. But when they realize that this movement poses such a tremendous threat to freedom of speech, that you no longer are going to be able to just state something that you observe, a certain person is a male, and that's a fact. But when that becomes categorized as hate speech, that's affecting everyone. And language is the touchstone to reality. So when you have a culture that is changing the meaning of words and criminalizing the use of reality-based language, you have a problem that is soon going to become coercive and really restrictive of, again, freedom of speech, but also freedom of religion.
You mentioned the response of the church. The U.S. bishops have released guidelines. They released them a year ago this month to help Catholics understand how to confront gender ideology. In your opinion, has this made a difference, this pastoral guidance?
Yeah, it was a very clear document. It was a document from the USCCB Doctrine Committee. It's called a doctrinal note, and they were specifically addressing the morality of medical and surgical interventions. In other words, the attempt to try to change your body to approximate the appearance of someone of the opposite sex, which is, first of all, an impossibility. But their analysis is really instructive. They start with the human person, what we know to be true, and then they talk about the harm, they talk about what this is. So it's a good document for people to read. But I think, too, one of the key things about that document was it set the stage for something else that's in motion, and that's for the bishops to revise the ethical and religious directives that pertain to Catholic healthcare institutions. And the directives that are out there now are more general. We need more specificity to really guide healthcare providers so that they are doing what is respectful and upholding of the dignity of the person and are not contributing to the harm of vulnerable people. So we're going to see more from the bishops as well as the individual bishops who have put out statements and policies. And that's a good thing. People need that guidance. And I think they're looking for it.
Absolutely. Well, we certainly saw the effects of a lack of clarity around the abortion debate, and now clarity being forward, faith forward, right, with the transgender debate as well. Mary, quickly, what can the everyday American do when faced with what might feel as a cultural onslaught? This is just overwhelming, this whole conversation we just had. There's a lot of technical stuff that is implicated here.
Yeah, so I'd say two things. One, be unfailingly kind to people who are struggling, because there are people who have been confused or just are struggling because of their own backgrounds and vulnerabilities. Be unfailingly kind, but be willing to speak the truth. The same God who's the God of love is the God of truth. And that's how we help people live in a way that is good for them. We have to be convinced of that and then be willing to speak the truth in our immediate circles in a kind way, just putting out some facts. You can't change sex. So what's this all about? Why go through all these medical and surgical interventions in a way that's just going to disrupt the function, the natural function of your body, that's going to cause harm and doesn't produce any benefit? So even just on an evidentiary level, you can sometimes begin to reach people. So love people and speak the truth.
Well, that's great guidance. It's always wonderful to see you, Mary. Thank you for joining us.
Me too. Thank you for having me.
Before we go, I want to remind you to join me across the United States and in Indianapolis for the National Eucharistic Pilgrimages and Congress this May to July. You can get discounted tickets through EWTN and find more information about the revival at EWTN.com/Eucharist to sign up. That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Don't forget, you can find us at EWTN Pro-Life on all social media platforms, X, Facebook, Instagram, we're there. And if you're interested in more news from our nation and world, go to EWTN.com/pro-life and sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.